Or did I? No, actually. I didn't. Note to self: when you can ask yourself if you want to before you do. After Boys on the Side, I returned to Malibu. Now with my own loft on the beach, I started taking acting classes for the first time because I thought it was time to start learning the craft that I had practically fallen into. In the past, I'd always just gone with my instincts and they had served me well. Now I was back in school getting an education on how to read a script, what to look for, how to prepare for a role, how to study, how to be. I thought a professional actor. Meanwhile, I hadn't gotten work in the 6 months since wrapping Boys on the Side. I hadn't worked since I started taking. Those acting classes had a lot of auditions and quite a few callbacks, but I couldn't seem to land a gig. I wondered why. I noticed I was more uptight and not taking as many risks in the auditions as I used to. I was tense. I was earnest. I was literal. I was heady. The new intellectual exercise had me getting in my own way. Note to self: the intellect is not meant to surpass the appearance so far as to conceal it or make it more confusing. It is meant to expose the truth more clearly and reveal more of the obvious for more lines of sight. It should simplify things, not make them more cerebral. Finally, I received a blind offer for a minor role in a small independent film called Scorpion Spring. I'd only be in one scene. They offered 10 grand and I took it, no audition shooting in 2 weeks. That's all I knew. I decided that that was all I wanted to know. I got the script and I didn't read one page of it. Not a word, not even of the scene I was in. Why? Because I had a bright idea to lubricate my creative juices and rid myself of all the theoretical tension I had been carrying since the last movie. In those classes, I decided I was going to go back to how I acted when I first started, when I played this guy named David Wooderson. When reading just one line of the script, completely unlocked the character for me. It was easy for me to improvise and all those other unscripted scenes and days to confuse because I was confident I knew who my man was comfortable to. Just say and do what Wooderson would in any scene, the director put me in. Back when I was all instinct and natural. Well, I said to myself, that's what I've been missing enough of this academic, tight-minded learned studying. I've been doing. It's time to return to my roots. In Scorpion Spring, my man was an American drug runner in South Texas who meets up with the Mexican coyotes smuggling his dope back into the States, who then reneges on the deal, doesn't pay for the smuggled drugs and instead kills the smugglers and takes the cocaine for free. That's all I needed to know. Just be that guy, handled the situation like he would improvise McConaughey do what my man would do easy. 2 weeks later, I'm on location in my trailer. I know my man. I've created my backstory of an upper mid-level drug runner who worked for the cartel on the American side in Texas. I need the cocaine and the money, and I'm carrying a loaded pistol willing to kill to get out alive with both. I even look the part: unshaven, greasy black hair, black boots, leather jacket. Who needs a script? I knew who I impress record I got this. Time to go to set, time to shoot the scene. No problem. I arrive in character. I don't talk to anyone. I don't introduce myself to the other actors in the scene with me because my man doesn't care about them and my man is going to kill them in this scene. Anyway, I just want my cocaine for free just before we take our marks. A production assistant comes up to me. Some sides. Mr. McKay, I take them and just shove them in my pocket without looking at him. All the actors settle onto their marks and prepare for action. Here we go. Well, I guess I lost my nerve a little bit because I decided it would be a good idea right at this moment, just before we roll the camera, to have a quick peek at the scene and the dialogue. My thinking at the time: if it's written well, I'll immediately remember the written lines, because obviously that's what my man would say. And if it's not written well, then I'll just be my man and do and say what he would do and say anyway. I unfold the sides and have a look. One page. Two pages. Three pages. Four pages. Of a monologue. In Spanish. I feel a bit of sweat form on the back of my neck. My heart starts racing. What the am I going to do? My mouth goes dry. I try to keep calm, and then I look up to no one in particular, and aloud to the set I say, "Can I get 12 minutes, please?" My thinking was that 12 minutes would one be enough time to memorize all the Spanish, because hey, I took a semester of Spanish class in the 11th grade, and two, not enough time to inconvenience the crew. I take a little walk with the sides, a 12-minute walk to be precise. I then return to set, put the sides back in my pocket, and step to my mark. The director says action and we shoot the scene. I have never watched Scorpion Spring. I did learn a good lesson that day, though. We have to prepare to have freedom. We have to do the work to then do the job. We have to prepare for the job so we can be free to do the work. Knowing my man does not mean I know Spanish. Note to self, we must learn the consequences of negligence. It's not just what we do, it's what we don't do. That's important as well. We are guilty by omission. A few months later, having quit the acting classes, but learned my lesson, I was back on the Warner Brothers lot and director Joel Schumacher's office to discuss a possible role in his next film. A Time to Kill. Based on the book by John Grisham, the irresponsibility of my half-cocked idea not to fully prepare for the last part had value. I was embarrassed. Embarrassment me off, and that rage made me more daring. Joel and I were meeting to discuss the part of Freddie Lee Cobb, a young head of the Ku Klux Klan, in a small Mississippi town. I had read the script this time. I'd even read the book. Freddie Lee Cobb was a strong and stirring role, but it wasn't the one I wanted. No, the man I wanted was the lead, Jake Brigance, a young lawyer who defends a black man for killing the man who raped his daughter. I showed up in Joe's office that day with the plan, wearing a sleeveless John Mellencamp t-shirt and casually smoking a Marlboro. I sat across the desk from him. "I think you'd be a great Freddie Lee Cobb, Matthew," he said. "Yeah, I do too. Mr. Schumacher, I understand you know where he came from and why he is who he is, but who's playing the lead role of Jake Brigance?" Joe paused and cocked his head a bit. "I don't know," he said. "Who do you think should?" I leaned back in my chair, took a healthy dragon on the exhale, looking him dead in the eyes, said, "I think I should." Joel burst into laughter. "I think that's a great idea, Matthew, but it is never going to happen. The studio will never put a relatively unknown actor in the lead role." I stubbed out my cigarette and held his gaze. I pulled off the first part of my plan. Note to self, if only. Means you wanted something but did not get it for some reason, either by your own incompetence or the world's intervention. It did not happen. Sometimes this is just the breaks and we need to bow out gracefully, but more often than we care to admit, we don't get what we want because we quit early or we didn't take the necessary risk to get it. The more boots we put in the backside of our if-onlys, the more we will get what we want. Don't walk to it's too late. It's too soon, tightrope until you die. Huh. Now, what happened next was certainly not part of my plan, but a lot of things that were out of my control went my way. Sandra Bullock, who was already cast as Ellen Rourke in A Time to Kill, had recently starred in a film called While You Were Sleeping, which had recently opened with a respectable first weekend of just under $10 million. But since I'd planted the seed with Joel, While You Were Sleeping had crept up to over $80 million in domestic box office revenue. It was a big head, and it made Sandra Hollywood's newest green light movie star. Which meant that studios believed she was popular enough to headline a film. With an actress who could now open a film already cast in the number 3 supporting role in A Time to Kill, Warner Brothers was suddenly free to consider a less bankable actor for the lead role. But did that mean Joel Schumacher started to take my suggestion seriously? Apparently not. They were considering my now great friend and brother from another mother, Woody Harrelson, for the role of Jake Brigance. Then the plot twist. It again, turns out, John Grisham also had casting approval on the role of Jake Brigance, as the character was based on himself. Also, turns out that on March 7, 1995, a man named Bill Savage was murdered in Mississippi. The murders, a young man and woman said they were inspired by Mickey and Mallory. The characters brought to life by Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis and Oliver Stone's natural-born killers. Bill Savage was John Grisham's friend, and there was no way the guy who played Mickey in that film was going to play Jake Brigance in this one. Filming was scheduled to commence in 68 weeks in Canton, Mississippi. All the roles were cast except for Jake Brigance. A couple of weeks later, I was on the rooftop of a Mexican restaurant in LA, having a 4 p.m. margarita with my manager, Beth Holden. When my phone rang. "I want you to come in for a screen test," Matthew Joel Schumacher said over the phone. "It had been 2 months since I planted the seed. We'll do it next Sunday in a small private studio on Fairfax, so no one will know, because even if you do great, it's such a long shot that the studio will approve you. I don't want the perceived failure to be on your resume around town. The scene I want you to test with is Jake's final summation." Sunday came. It was Mother's Day. I called mine at daybreak. "Don't you walk in there like you want the role?" Matthew walked in there like you own it. Just what I needed to hear. Thanks, Mom. Happy Mother's Day. Note to self: made for the moment. We are all made for every moment we encounter. Whether the moment makes us or we make the moment, whether we are helpless in it or on top of it, the predator or the prey, we are made for that moment. A black car picked me up at 11 a.m. and drove me to the studio on Fairfax. There was a makeup artist and costume designer, a director of photography, and a crew of around 30 people. Around 1 p.m. I walked onto the set, which was a courtroom with 12 actors all sitting in a set-made jury box. I was nervous, but I was prepared. Everyone quieted down and took their places. "Whenever you're ready," Matthew Joel said. I caught my breath and began to enact the final summation just as it was written in the script until I finished it with the now classic line. "Now. Imagine she's white." It was good, not great. I had remembered my lines, hit all the beach, taken my time and told the story well, more than passable but nothing special. "Great," Matthew Joel said. "Now throw away the script and just say what you'd say." Therein lies Joel Schumacher's genius. "Be you, you are the character I love, that note what I would say and do. How do I feel about a young virgin girl being raped by three vile men? What did they kill in her that day? What if she was my sister? What if it was my daughter?" It was Mother's Day. I tossed the script off the set and out of my mind I began to slowly pace. My eyes began to burn and with rage building I painted the dreadful pictures in my mind, then said what I saw. Not yet a father myself, but the father being the only thing I ever knew I wanted to be. I imagine my daughter getting raped. I forgot testing. I forgot time. I said and did things. A lawyer in courtroom would never say or do. I cussed. I spit, I painted cringe-worthy pictures of the child's lost innocence with bloody words that could have put me in jail alongside those I was condemning. I got sick to my stomach. I got violent, I broke a sweat. I nailed it. 2 weeks later, working on the set of Lone Star in Eagle Pass, Texas in the full moon desert at midnight, I got a phone call. It was Joel Schumacher and John Grisham. "You want to be Jake Brigance?" "You damn right? I do." I ran off into the night until I was about a mile away from anyone. Then with tears in my eyes, I dropped to my knees, faced that full moon, extended my right hand up to it, and said thank you. Green light ready for a prescribe. Here we go. A roof is a man-made thing. January 3, 1993 NFL Playoffs. Houston Oilers versus the Buffalo Bills. The Oilers are up 28-3 at halftime, 35-3 early in the third. Frank Reich and the Bills come back to win 41-38 in overtime for one of the greatest comebacks in NFL history. Yeah, the Bills won, but they didn't really beat the Oilers. The others lost that game. They beat themselves. Why? Because at halftime they put a ceiling, a roof, a limit on their belief in themselves, aka the prevent defense. Maybe they started thinking about the next opponent at halftime, played on their heels, lost their mental edge the entire second half, and voila, they lost in a mere two quarters. Defensive coordinator Jim Eddy went from being called defensive coordinator of the year, and the man first in line to be a head coach next year, to a man without a job in the NFL or even college football the next year. You ever choked? You know what I mean? Fumble at the goal line, stuck your foot in your mouth when you were trying to ask that girl out on a date. Had a brain freeze on the final exam you were totally prepared for, lipped out a 3-foot putt to win the golf tournament, or been paralyzed by the feeling of, oh my god, life can't get any better. Do I really deserve this? I have what happens when we get that feeling weak lean to, we get shorter breath, self-conscious. We have an out-of-body experience where we observe ourselves in the third person, no longer present now, not doing well what we are there to do. We become voyeurs of our moment because we let it become bigger than us, and in doing so we just became less involved in it and more impressed with it. Why does this happen? It happens because when we mentally give a person, place, or point in time more credit than ourselves, we then create a fictitious ceiling, a restriction over the expectations we have of our own performance. In that moment we get tense. We focus on the outcome instead of the activity, and we miss the doing of the deed. We either think the world depends on the result or it's too good to be true. But it doesn't and it isn't, and it's not our right to believe it does or is. Don't create imaginary constraints. A leading role, a blue ribbon, a winning score, a great idea, the love of our life, euphoric bliss. Who are we to think we don't deserve these fortunes when they're in our grasp? Who are we to think? We haven't earned them. If we stay in process within ourselves, in the joy of the doing, we will never choke at the finish line. Why? Because we aren't thinking of the finish line. We're not looking at the clock, we're not watching ourselves on the Jumbotron performing. We are performing in real time where the approach is the destination, and there is no goal line, because we are never finished. When Bo Jackson scored, he ran over the goal line through the end zone and up the tunnel. The greatest snipers and marksmen in the world don't aim at the target. They aim on the other side of it. When we truly latch onto the fact that we are going to die at some point in time, we have more presence in this one. Reach beyond your grasp, have immortal finish lines, and turn your red light green because a roof is a man-made thing? The day of the opening of A Time to Kill, I strolled to my favorite deli on the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica, California, get a tuna fish sandwich on toasted sourdough with extra pickles and ketchup on the side. It was like any other stroll down the promenade for me. 400 or so people milling about 396 made nothing of me, forwarded a few girls who thought I was cute, and one dude who liked my shoes. That night, A Time to Kill premiered in theaters across America and grossed $15 million in its opening weekend, a box office hit in 1996. The following Monday, I went back to the promenade to get another tuna fish sandwich on toasted sourdough with extra pickles and ketchup on the side. It was not like any other stroll down the promenade for me. 400 or so people milling about 396 stared at me for did not three babies and a blind man. I checked my fly and lightly thumbed my nose to see if I had a booger hanging out. I didn't. What the? I was famous. Note to self, sometimes you have etc. Sometimes etc. has you. The hype surrounding my arrival was off the charts, being hailed as the next big thing. Matthew McConaughey saves the movies was the BF caption behind my head on the cover of certain industry magazines. Save the movies? Hell, I didn't know they needed saving, and if they did, I wasn't sure I was or wanted to be the one to save him. I just wanted to act, to play roles that interested me and stories that mattered to me. From that day on, the world became a mirror. Strangers laid their hands on me and spoke to me like they knew me. Well, actually, they weren't strangers at all anymore. People I'd never seen or met before would approach me and say my dog had cancer too. I am so sorry about Miss Hud. And I thought, how did you know I had a dog? How did you know her name? How did you know she might have cancer? What happened to introducing yourself? Everyone had a preconceived bio of me. Now, honest first impressions were a thing of the past. That check had been cashed. My world had changed, in the words of James McMurtry. Now it's upside down and backwards. The foot's on the other shoe. Everyone loved me now, and they weren't shy to say it out loud and often me. I'd only said it to 4 people in my life. Anonymous. No more and forever. The same happened with scripts the Friday before opening weekend. There were 100 scripts that I wanted to do. 99 no's, 1. Yes, the Monday after 99 yes is 1. No, wow, awesome. What was real? What was not? This guy just opened up to me, and it was tough to feel the ground beneath my feet. My differential split my spiritual foundation in flight. I needed some gravity. It was time to bend my knee bone. Prescribe why we all need to walk about. Noise to signal ratio. We are more constantly bombarded by unnatural stimuli than ever before. We need to put ourselves in places of decreased sensory input so we can hear the background signals of our psychological processes. As the noise decreases, the signals become clearer. We can hear ourselves again. We can reunite. Time alone simplifies the heart, memory catches up, opinions form, we meet truth again, and it teaches us, landing on stable feet between our reaching out and retreat. Letting us know we're not lonely in our state, just alone, because our unconscious mind now has room to reveal itself, we see it again. It dreams, perceives, and thinks in pictures, which we now can observe. In this solitude, we then begin to think in pictures and actualize what we see. Our souls become anonymous again, and we realize we are stuck with the one person we can never be rid of. Ourselves. The Socratic dialogue can be ugly, painful, lonesome, hard, guilt-ridden, and a nightmare vicious enough to need a mouth guard. Not in our fangs into nubs while we sweat cold and feverish panic, we are forced to confront ourselves. And this is good. We more than deserve this suffrage, we've earned it. An honest man's pillow is his peace of mind, and no matter who's in our bed each night, we sleep with ourselves. We either forgive or get sick and tired of it. Herein lies the evolution. Now with nowhere to run and forced to deal with ourselves, our ugly everyday suppressions break out of the zoo and monkey around where we find ourselves in the ring, with him deciding no more or let it slide. Whatever the verdict, we grow. It's us and us are always and only company. We tend to ourselves and getting good graces once again. Then we return to civilization, able to better tend to our tendencies. Why? Because we took a walkabout. The monastery of Christ in the desert sits in miles of undisturbed desert on the banks of the Chama River in Ibiquiú, New Mexico. The 13.5-mile dirt RD from the highway that leads you. There is usually washed out so you can't bring a car. Thomas Merton loved it there, he said. This monastery was a place where people can go to readjust their perspectives. I read about it in a book and thought that's exactly what I needed. This time a spiritual realignment. I was all messed up in the head, lost in the excess of my newfound fame and struggling with the non-deserving complex. My now roofless existence not only had me searching for my bearings, it was bearing down on me. How could a working-class kid from Uvalde, Texas be deserving of all this opulence and accolade? I didn't know how to navigate the decade into my success, much less believe it was mine to enjoy. I didn't know who to trust, including myself. In the book, the brothers said that if you can get to us, just ring the bell and we'll take you in. A good friend and I drove from Hollywood to that dirt RD where he dropped me off, and I made the 13.5-mile march to the monastery. I arrived an hour after sundown and rang the bell. Dressed in a coal and tunica, short man, named Brother Andre greeted me, "Welcome, brother. All travelers have a place to stay here." I washed up and went to the group dinner where psalms were read aloud. In talking was strictly prohibited. Later, Brother Andre ushered me to a small, simple room with a cot and a sleeping mat on the floor where I lay down for the night. The next day I said to Brother Andre, "I need to talk to someone about some things going on in my life and in my mind. Do you know who I could talk to?" "Yes," he said, "Brother Christian would be a good man for you to talk to about such things." I met Brother Christian and we went for a long walk in the desert. I unloaded my feelings of guilt, the low and lecherous places my mind had been traveling, the perverseness of my thoughts. "Since becoming famous," I professed, I've tried to be a good man, you know, to not lie and deceive myself, to be more pure of heart and mind. But I am full of lust, objectifying other people and myself. I do not feel a connection to my past nor see a path to my future. I'm lost, I just don't feel myself. I shared the demons of my mind for 3.5 hours with Brother Christian. I took myself to the woodshed. He did not say a word, not one. He just patiently listened as we wandered side by side through the desert. At hour 4, we found ourselves back at the chapel, sitting on a bench just outside the entrance. Now weeping. I eventually came to the end of my confession. We sat in silence while I awaited Christian's judgment. "Nothing." Finally, in the unrest of the stillness, I looked up. Brother Christian, who hadn't said one word to me this entire time, looked me in the eyes and almost a whisper said to me, "Me too. Sometimes you see we don't need advice. Sometimes we just need to hear we're not the only one. Green light prescription time again, both are true. Now look, I'm an optimist by nature. My eyes high, I have hope, and the man I want to be sleeps in the same bed with the man I am in head, heart, spirit and body. I don't always enjoy my company because of that Jiminy Cricket, but I'm rarely able to knock him off my shoulder either, and for good reason, even when I'm out of tune off frequency. Having trouble feeling any traction or viscosity between my being and my actions. Or alternately, when I am so lost in the music that I am unaware, my best self is always there and he will start the Socratic dialogue sooner than I choose to hear him. And long after I want to, because he's insatiable, I have course eventually do hear him. Then the challenge becomes to listen. Once I do this and stop pitting fate against responsibility, truth against fiction, sins against who I wish I was, selfishness against selflessness, mortality against eternity. I learn and then begin just being who I am and doing what I do for me, not for anyone else and for everyone else at the same time. For me and God together, then I realize I am responsible for fate, fiction is truthful, a sinner and a saint I am, an egotistical utilitarian as well. I'll be mortal forever. Now each step at a time has the big picture in mind, and I am the man I want to be. Jiminy Cricket is a bluebird on my shoulder and Socrates has one voice. I didn't mishandle my newfound fame as much as I just didn't really have a handle on it. I was numb, occasionally dumb, and picked a few battles that did not need picking. If I was thrown off balance for a bit, it was mainly because I gave a damn and it mattered to me what it all meant and didn't. Mostly I danced lightly between the raindrops. I enjoyed being able to finally put super unleaded gasoline in my truck, picking up the tab when I went out with my friends. Getting the backstage passes and working with so many talented people, I tried to remain a gentleman and accept the caviar fine wines and I love yous with grace, but a lot of it felt like the maid was still pressing my jeans after I asked her not to. I made sure to call my mom every Sunday. Only now it wasn't my mom. I was calling anymore. It wasn't my mom who was listening to me. It wasn't my mom who was talking to her son. It was a woman who was more enamored with my fame than I was. This was never more evident than when I got a call at home from a friend one night. "Dude, you watching this? Watching what? Put it on channel 7 hard copy." My friend says I turn on the tube, put it on channel 7, and there's my mother talking to the camera that is following her through our house on a guided tour. And this is the bed where he lost his virginity to Melissa. I think her name was anyway, doesn't matter. She didn't last, and this is his bathroom. Just a shower. No bathtub, man. You know what? I caught him doing in there. But trust me, it's no big deal. I've seen it plenty of times. Oh, I call mom, mom. What did you do? What hard copy? What hard copy? Mom, I'm watching it right now. You are too. I can hear it in the background. Oh, that yeah, that I didn't think you'd find out, ma'am. It's on national television. How would I not find out? Sadly, my relationship with my mom was strenuous for the next 8 years. Loose lips sink ships. I kept telling her. She tried it, didn't matter. She couldn't help herself. She wanted a piece of my fame, and while I was still finding my balance with it, I wasn't self-assured enough to share it with anyone else, especially my own mother. The more she wanted a piece of my place, the more I locked her out. If Dad were alive, he would have loved my success, but unlike Mom, he would have been in the front row, not trying to steal my show. With Mom, as soon as I'd show up, she was saying come back soon, so I started leaving early. I'd give her an edge and she'd take a mile, so when she didn't meet me halfway, I started walking twice as slow to make her wait twice as long. I quit sharing any of my life or experiences with her. I couldn't trust her. I didn't need another friend on my bandwagon. I needed my mom, and unfortunately she was on another type of extended vacation. Years later, with my feet more firmly on the ground and my career established, I finally said you know what, bucket, and loosened the reins on her. She was in her 70s and I figured I might as well let her have all the fun she wants to. And to this day she does. She loves the red carpet, doing interviews and telling the world she knows where I got it from. Her. She's got a point. Note to self: the art of running downhill. Don't trip yourself while running downhill that mountain you want to climb. It's just around the corner. Don't invent drama. It will come on its own. It's been 4 months since The Time to Kill had been released, and I was in high demand. Warner Brothers, who I signed a 3-picture deal with prior to doing The Time to Kill, was anxiously anticipating my next role. Dozens of offers came my way. I even started a production company to create material of my own. I was hungry to go to work. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. One of my strengths has always been that I can find an angle on anything, but now with the ability to do almost anything, that strength was a weakness. Every project looked possible to me. Note to self: a man addicted to ideas need be intervened with starvation. A man addicted to truth need be fed. Feeling pressure to make a decision on my next movie, smothered by the blind affections of my recent fame and having a new wild card for a mom. I wanted to go somewhere where nobody knew my name. I needed to reaffirm that I, Matthew, not my fame, was justification for any adulation I received. I needed to go someplace where any affections I collected will be solely based on the man those strangers met and got to know after I arrived, not before. I needed to hear myself think, to check out, to check in. So I could settle into my new position of leverage and measure it, get less impressed with it, find some discernment, and figure out what kind of role and what type of film I wanted to do next. I needed some starvation. Then I had a wet dream. Yes, the involuntary intercourse hands and free nocturnal emission of semen one has while sleeping, rare but welcomed. These lucid dreams most commonly involve a theme of sexual activity. This wet dream was not common. I was seeing myself floating downstream on my back in the Amazon River, wrapped up by anacondas and pythons, surrounded by crocodiles, piranhas, and freshwater sharks. There were African tribesmen lined up shoulder to shoulder on the ridge to the left of me. As far as my eyes could see,